Chapter 17. Accelerated Pacification. The election of Richard Nixon in November 1968 signaled a shift in U.S. policy in Vietnam, reflecting the desire of most Americans in the wake of Tet for an honorable withdrawal. The policy balanced negotiations with the bombing of North Vietnam. Called the Nixon Doctrine, the policy had as its premise that the United States has a moral obligation to support foreign governments fighting communist insurgents, on the condition that those governments supply their own cannon fodder. Shortly after taking office, Nixon instructed his National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger, to start negotiating with the North Vietnamese in Paris. On the assumptions that Tet had dealt the VCI a death blow and that the Thieu regime was firmly in control of the country, Nixon began planning for troop reductions. Following in the footsteps of the French, U.S. forces began a gradual retreat to coastal enclaves, and MACV, under General William Westmoreland's replacement, General Creighton Abrams, prepared to fight a sanctuary war based on CIA estimates that 40,000 NVA soldiers hunkered down in Cambodia constituted the major outside threat to the Thieu regime. The bombing of these potential invaders began in February 1969 with the consent of Cambodia's Prince Norodom Sihanouk, whose agents provided the Special Operations Group, SOG, with information on the location of enemy forces, many of which were located in densely populated areas. Conducted in secret, the illegal raids into Cambodia were revealed in May 1969 and resulted in increased opposition to U.S. government conduct in Southeast Asia. The Nixon Doctrine, as applied in Vietnam, was called Vietnamization, and the man upon whom the mantle of Vietnamization fell was William Colby, godfather of the covert action program that had set the stage for American intervention 10 years earlier. In November 1968, Colby was appointed DEPCORDS, replacing Democratic Party loyalist Robert Comer, whom President Johnson had named U.S. ambassador to Turkey. Colby reported to Henry Kissinger, who supported Colby's ambitious pacification program geared to facilitate Vietnamization. Colby subdivided his pacification plan into three main categories, beginning with military security, which he called the first step in the pacification and development process. In other words, borrowed from Nelson Brigham, shielding the population from the communist main forces, a job which is the task of the Vietnamese regular forces. Often generated by Phoenix intelligence, the resulting air raids, artillery barrages, and search-and-destroy operations were an integral part of pacification, insofar as they created defectors, prevented guerrillas from assembling in large concentrations, and, by creating refugees, separated the fish from the water. Part two of Colby's strategy was territorial security, the 1969 manifestation of revolutionary development, in which the regional and popular forces, thereafter called territorial security forces, were advised by U.S. Army Mobile Advisory Teams, MATS, under the auspices of CORDS. In combating VC guerrilla units and the VCI, territorial security forces were assisted by the People's Self-Defense Forces. In a Defense Department report titled A Systems Analysis of the Vietnam War 1965 to 1972, Thomas Thayer says that as of 1968, the Revolutionary Development Program had significant problems in recruiting and retaining high-quality personnel. The RD cadre desertion rate was over 20%, higher than for any GVN military force, perhaps because they have a 30% better chance of being killed than the military forces. Thayer notes that in response, the RD ministry had directed its cadre to concentrate on building hamlet security and to defer, at least temporarily, the hamlet development projects which formerly constituted 6 of the team's 11 RD tasks. Under these revised guidelines, providing intelligence to Phoenix replaced nation building as the RD program's top priority. Reflecting this change, the RD cadre program was incorporated within the CORDS Pacification Security Coordination Division in November 1968, at which point MACV officers and USAID employees moved in to manage the program, bringing about, according to Robert Pert and Jim Ward, a decline in performance and morale. In line with Lew Lapham's redirection of the station away from paramilitary operations back toward classic intelligence functions, the CIA's role in RD diminished, although it continued to skim off whatever strategic intelligence was produced. As Pert noted, The station was interested in going after region people and would get involved at that point in RDCO operations. To a lesser degree, the CIA's PRU program was also affected. The agency made a decision, John Wilbur said, to get their ass out of Vietnam as fast as they could, for all the reasons Kinloch Bull foretold. It was losing control, diluting its cadre, being misdirected. It had become the sponsoring agency for a hodgepodge thing, and Phoenix was going to be the mechanism by which it was going to withdraw its control and sponsorship and transition it over to the military. And that meant that the PRU were no longer going to be the CIA's exclusive boys, which foretold a real human crisis in the units. Their elan and morale had been carefully nurtured, Wilbur explained. We protected them from the dilution of control, from the province chiefs and battalion commanders. We insulated them from being used for whatever multiple good and bad reasons other people wanted to use them for. We would pay them a little better, we would take care of their dependents, and we would provide them with the best military support there was. That, according to Wilbur, motivated them to go out and do the things they did. But he added, they had incurred a lot of resentment by the Vietnamese to whom they had previously been untouchable. The leadership levels were marked men among many Vietnamese political forces. And as soon as the Vietnamese got control in the summer of 1968, everybody started messing with them. The PRU began to be used as bagmen. I was hurt in the last attack on Con Tu, Wilbur continued, and when I got back from the hospital, my replacement had already arrived. And I spent most of the next 6 weeks introducing Chuck, Lieutenant Commander Charles Lemoyne, to the provinces, to all the hundreds of people he would have to deal with. At that point, Wilbur went home, where he remained until May 1968, when the CIA asked him to return to Vietnam to help Bill Riddell develop a national PRU unit that was targeted to recover American POWs in South Vietnam. It was the only thing that seemed worth fighting for, Wilbur said, so he accepted the job. He was transferred to a naval security group, assigned to MACV, given an office, formerly occupied by Joe Vaccaro, on the second floor of USAID 2, and went to work for Riddell. We were going to set up a unit that would go around the provinces and try to collate whatever extent information there was, and in the event there was something that indicated a POW camp was there, we would try to put an in-place person or try to develop somebody to deal with an agent in place, and then gather the intelligence sufficiently to mount some sort of rescue operation. But the rescue program was scuttled, and Wilbur instead got the job of transferring management of the PRU to the Vietnamese. He was introduced to Special Forces Mayor Nguyen Van Long, the first PRU national commander, and they began traveling around the country together. And it became very apparent when I showed up with a Vietnamese colonel what was going to happen. It meant the military, and that meant that the leadership elements of the PRU were in jeopardy of maintaining allegiance. They weren't colonels and majors and captains. Wilbur sighed and said forlornly, the fact that there was no national overlay allowed the CIA to maintain autonomy over the PRU program longer than they would have otherwise. But by the summer of 1968, the official word had to go out that the PRU was becoming part of the Phoenix program. We're going to lose control. Get ready for the transition. It was the dissolution of American protection of the units that was mandated in our withdrawal, Wilbur explained, that corrupted the quality of control, which in turn allowed the PRU to be turned into a department store. And I became an agent of that. I was going to try to convince people to give up control of the PRU after I had spent all this time arguing for its insulation and control and independence. To affect territorial security, Colby intended to get weapons into the hands of the Vietnamese villagers so they could participate in their own defense, and to provide funds to the elected village leaders to carry out local development programs. The mechanism for this was Ralph Johnson's Village Chief Program at Vung Tau, about which Professor Huy writes, after 1968, when Tu succeeded to restore security in the countryside, several province and district chiefs used fraud and threats to put their men in the village and hamlet councils. These men were often children of rich people living in the cities. They needed the title of elected representatives of the population to enjoy a temporary exemption from military service, and their parents were ready to pay a high price for their selection as village councillors. Thus, even the fiercely anti-communist groups became bitter and resentful against Tu. That brings us to part three of Colby's plan, internal security, otherwise known as Phoenix, the two-track CIA program to destroy the VCI and ensure the political stability of the Tu regime by insulating him from the backlash of his repressive policies. As it was in the beginning, the pacification purpose of Phoenix was to weaken the link between the people and the VCI, while the political level Phoenix was designed to exploit that link. To implement his plan, Colby forged ahead with a three-month startup program dubbed the Accelerated Pacification Campaign, APC. Begun in November 1968, APC was designed to bolster Kissinger's negotiating position in Paris by boosting the GVN presence in the hamlets, and was expected to show its effect by Tet of 1969. The goal was to add 1,200 hamlets to the 5,000 already classified under the Hamlet Evaluation System, HES, as relatively secure. Afterward, APC was to be followed by an annual full-year pacification and development program. To facilitate this process, Colby created the Central Pacification and Development Council as his personal staff and private conduit to Tran Tien Kim, who replaced Tran Van Hoang as Prime Minister in August 1969. Said Evan Parker about his patron William Colby, "The interesting thing was his relationship with Kim. They would travel around the countryside in the same plane, each sitting there with his briefcase and a stack of working papers, writing like mad, answering memoranda, writing memoranda, passing memorandum back and forth. There's your coordination on this stuff. One of them or both would use his authority to support what I was asking the Vietnamese to do." To assist him on the council, Colby hired Clayton McManaway as program manager, Tony Alito for HES reports, Harry Buzz Johnson for territorial security, and Ev Bumgartner and Frank Scotton for political liaison. With his personal staff in tow, Colby spent 2 days each week canvassing the provinces, bringing pressure to bear on people in the field, and promoting the accelerated pacification campaign. Phoenix advisor John Cook describes the accelerated pacification campaign as an all-out nationwide effort to put as many hamlets under government control as soon as possible. The Viet Cong violently opposed this action, since its primary purpose was to eliminate them and their control. It involved large military operations coupled with psychological operations, resulting in increased emphasis on the pacification program. Insofar as the attack on the VCI strengthened Henry Kissinger's bargaining position, Cook writes, pressure was placed on the intelligence and operations coordinating centers to provide more valuable information about the enemy's location. This required more of an effort from all of us, which meant an increase in the number of raids, ambushes, and operations. The hour of Phoenix was at hand. With American troops withdrawing and emphasis being shifted from military to political operations, the pressure began to mount on Phoenix advisors, who were expected to eliminate any vestiges of revolutionary activity in South Vietnam. Reasons why they failed to accomplish this goal are offered by Jeffrey Race in his book, War Comes to Long An. Blaming over-centralization, Race observes that the district, where the DIOCCs were located, was the lowest operational level of Phoenix, one having no significance in terms of social or living patterns, and staffed by outsiders whose interests bore no necessary connection to the districts. By contrast, the revolutionary organization was the essence of simplicity and intimately familiar with the local population and terrain. Race traces the lack of security at the village level to the GVN's disdain for the common people and its failure to develop a highly motivated and trained local apparatus. Operational as well as organizational errors also factored into the equation. Forces under the Phoenix program, Race explains, operated in a manner of a conventional war combat organization, independently of their environment, and so they did not have the enormous advantage enjoyed by the party apparatus of operating continuously in their home area through a personally responsive network of friends and relatives. This in turn severely handicapped their ability to locate intended targets and to recognize fortuitous ones. The program was also handicapped in developing a sympathetic environment by the use of the Saigon authorities of foreign troops and by the program's intended purpose of maintaining a distributive system perceived as unfavorable to their interests by much of the rural population. Responding to the grievances of the rural population and taking steps to correct social injustices might have enabled the GVN to collect intelligence and contest the VCI in the villages. but acknowledging the nature of the conflict would have undermined the reason for fighting the war in the first place. And rather than do that, Ray says, attention was turned to the use of such new devices as starlight scopes, ground surveillance radar, and remote listening devices, as well as the previously employed infrared and radio transmission detection devices. In August 1968, concurrent with Robert Comer imposing, as a management tool, a nationwide quota of 1,800 VCI neutralizations per month, the science fiction aspect of Phoenix was enhanced with the advent of the Viet Cong Infrastructure Information System. VCIIS climaxed a process begun in February 1966 when Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara established the Defense Department's Southeast Asia Programs Division. The process was carried forward in Saigon in January 1967 when the Combined Intelligence Staff fed the names of 3,000 VCI, assembled by hand at area coverage desks, into the IBM 1401 computer at the Combined Intelligence Center's Political Order of Battle section. At that point, the era of the computerized blacklist began. As the attack against the VCI exploded across South Vietnam in 1968, reports on the results poured into the Phoenix Directorate, inundating its analysts with reams of unreliable information on individual VCI and anti-VCI operations. In DIOCCs, the data could be processed manually, but in Saigon it required machines. Hence, with input from the Defense Intelligence Agency, the FBI, and the CIA, all of which had an interest in analyzing the finished product, VCIIS became the first of a series of computer programs designed to absolve the war effort of human error and war managers of individual responsibility. The cerebellum of Phoenix, VCIIS compiled information gathered from all U.S. and free world field units on VCI boundaries, locations, structures, strengths, personalities, and activities. The end product, a monthly summary report, was a statistical summary of Phoenix operational results by province, region, and the country as a whole, and showed the levels and methods of neutralizations at each echelon within the VC infrastructure. A monthly activity listing listed each neutralized VCI by name. In July 1970, the Vietnamese were invited to contribute to the program and started key punching at the National Police Interrogation Center. Until then, the computerized blacklist was a unilateral American operation. In January 1969, VCIIS was renamed the Phung Hoang Management Information System. The PHMIS file included summary data on each recorded VCI in the following categories: name and aliases, whether or not he or she was at large, sex, birth date and place of birth, area of operations, party position, source of information, arrest date, how neutralized, term of sentence, where detained, release date, and other biographical and statistical information, including photographs and fingerprints, if available. All confirmed and suspected VCI members were recorded in this manner, enabling Phoenix analysts instantly to access and cross-reference data, then decide who was to be erased. All of this added up to hard times for NLF sympathizers, TU opponents, and those unfortunate enough to be creditors or rivals of Phoenix agents. As a management tool, PHMIS was used by Comer and Colby to measure and compare the performance of Phoenix officers, unless one believes those like Tom McCoy, who claims that Comer was a fraud who went to Vietnam not to do pacification, but to prove that it was being done. In that case, the numbers game was computerized prestidigitation, an Orwellian manipulation of statistics to shape public opinion. According to McCoy's scenario, PHMIS was part of a larger hoax begun in January 1967 when Robert Comer introduced the Hamlet Evaluation System, HES, 18 factors subject to computer analysis for each of South Vietnam's 15,000 hamlets. These factors included data on VC military activity, GVN security capabilities, the strength of the VCI, revolutionary development activities, etc. The data were assembled by MACV district advisors, with a computer then putting the hamlets into one of three classes: A, secure; B, contested; or C, controlled by the VC. On the verge of Tet in December 1967, nearly half of South Vietnam's hamlets were rated A. 1 year later, more than half were rated A. As Public Safety Chief Frank Walton told me, we would get reports of provinces being 85% pacified and 90% pacified, and then when it got to the point that they were near 100%, figures had to be revised downward. It was done with computers, and that's where I first heard the term GIGO for garbage in, garbage out. The Hamlet evaluation system also included input on the known strengths of the 319 currently identified upper-level VCI organizations at COSVN, region, province, and district levels. The HES guesstimate of VCI strength in January 1969 was 75,500. Statistics on the VCI, definitions of the VCI, attitudes toward the VCI, all were subjective. Yet despite his own admission that we knew there was a VCI, but we could not be said to know very much about it, William Colby set about attacking it. Armed with technology that rendered the process obsolete, he set up standards and procedures by which to weed out the faults from the correct information. To ensure that Phoenix operations were mounted on factual information, the general rule was established that three separate sources must have reported a suspect before he could be put on the rolls. Thus, the VCI was put into three classes of offenders: A for leaders and party members, B for holders of other responsible jobs, and C for rank-and-file members and followers. And the decision was taken that those in the C category should be ignored, since Phoenix was directed against the VCI command and control structure and not the occasional adherent or supporter. To complement these safety procedures, Phoenix advisors and their Vietnamese counterparts were issued, in July 1968, the Yellow Book, published by the CIA under cover of the RAND Corporation. Officially titled The Modus Operandi of Selected Political Cadre, the Yellow Book described the operational patterns and procedures of VCI cadre and suggested possible actions to exploit them. In November 1968 came SOP 2, telling how to manage a DIOCC, and in December 1968 appeared the Green Book, Current Breakdown of Executive and Significant VCI Cadre. The Bible of Phoenix Advisors, the Green Book, listed all VCI job titles, assigned each an A, B, or C rating, and described the duration of detention suitable for each functionary. It told how the VCI routed messages, how they constructed and hid in tunnels, who was likely to know whom in the party organization, and other tips that would allow earnest Phoenix advisors to prioritize their targets so they could go after the big fish recorded in the Black Book kept in the situation section of each DIOCC and PIOCC. Other publications made available to Phoenix advisors included a biweekly newsletter that enabled advisors to share their favorable interrogation, operational, and briefing techniques, MACV's monthly Summary of VCI Activities, Combined Document Exploitation Center and Combined Intelligence Center Readouts, the PHMIS Monthly Report, and an eagerly awaited Phoenix End-of-Year Report. Perhaps the most far-reaching innovation of 1968 was the Phoenix Coordinator's Orientation Course, PCOC, which held its first classes at Vung Tau Seminary Camp in November 1968. The PCOC represented a final recognition that, as Doug Dillard remarked, MACV really had to account for it. To state it simply, military careers were now hitched to the Phoenix Star. The advent of the PCOC dovetailed neatly with a folderol of the Accelerated Pacification Campaign and the infusion into the Phoenix Directorate of a new generation of staff officers who brought with them new ideas and were confronted with new concerns, most concerning public relations. On the CIA side, Robert E. Hayes replaced Joe Sartiano as executive director, and Sartiano and two State Department officers began writing a plan to put Phung Hoang under the control of the National Police. On the military side, Colonel Robert E. Jones replaced William Greenwalt as deputy director. In September, Army Security Agency officer Lieutenant Colonel Richard Bradish stepped in as the military liaison to Special Branch. Bradish provided direct assistance to the Phung Hoang staff in Special Branch headquarters at the NPIC. He and the sergeant assisting him were the only military personnel who had desks there. "We were very busy," Bradish told me, "primarily advising the Special Branch in anti-infrastructure operations." Bradish also advised Vietnamese inspectors visiting Phung Hoang committees on how to bolster morale and improve record-keeping on VCI neutralizations. Bradish noted that Parker's military deputy, Colonel Jones, did not provide close supervision, a condition that was characteristic of the whole thing. "I was compartmented," Bradish said about himself and the other military personnel on the staff. We were outsiders. When I was there, Special Branch was Fung Huang, meaning that the CIA still controlled Phoenix, with the military there as window dressing. Likewise, Bradish observed, the Vietnamese at the Fung Huang office were putting on a show. They were not acting like they were at war, but like it was a normal job. In his judgment, the North Vietnamese were more committed. The Central Fung Huang Permanent Committee as of November 1968 looked like this. Chairman, General Tran Tien Kim. Assistant Chairman, Colonel Lee Trong Song. Fung Huang Plan, Lieutenant Colonel Loi Nguyen Tan. Planning Bureau, Mr. Duong Tan Ho. Intelligence Operations, Mr. Ha Van Tien. Action Programs, Mr. Mai Viet Zik. Inspections Bureau, Mr. Nguyen Van Hong. Cho Hoi Representative, Mr. Lei Duan Hong. Statistics Bureau, Military Security Service, Captain Ding Zuan Mai. Also arriving at the Phoenix Directorate in September 1968, concurrent with its reorganization into separate branches for plans and training, was Lieutenant Colonel Walter Cullen. Put in charge of training, Cullen's job was to prepare incoming personnel at seminary camp at Vung Tau, which in 1969 was still the private property of the CIA. Only Air America was authorized to fly in and out. Having worked with the agency at various stages in his career, including his first tour in Vietnam in 1965 with the Special Military Intelligence Advisory Team, SMIAT, Phoenix was a program that Walter Cullen was well suited for. Assembled by CA officer William Tidwell within MACV's Technical Intelligence Branch, SMIAT was a deep cover for sophisticated black operations against the VCI before Phoenix. The premise and charter of SMIAT, said Cullen, lay the groundwork conceptually for Phoenix. When Cullen arrived on the scene, CIA contract officers like Bob Slater and veteran Phoenix coordinators like Doug Dillard and Henry McQuade were teaching classes at Vung Tau. Recall Dillard, there was a compound and classrooms and different kinds of training facilities out on the grounds. Colonel Bay was there with his R.D. Cadre training school, although they kept them separate. And, of course, I was involved only with American personnel. They had agency people who had been with ISICS as instructors. The U.S. cadre down there were all agency people. Later, they began to get some Army personnel in. Phoenix personnel assigned to seminary camp shared their mess hall with PRU advisors. We had two elements, Walter Cullen recalled. One was the Phoenix School, the other was PRU. Those were the only two there. The RDC training area was separate. But the people being assigned were neither fish nor fowl. Counterintelligence and intelligence people had no understanding of police or judicial procedures, and former policemen were not the solution either, he added, noting that they and people from other agencies sometimes had no intelligence training at all. What was needed was a new breed of cat, a person who understood collection, analysis, and response units like the National Field Police, and how all that jibed with gathering evidence and building a case. So, Cullen continued, we made recommendations to Colby to get a new program underway in the States. Then I went back to brief the people at SACSA, CIA, Fort Holabird, and the Continental Army Command at Fort Lee as to what our needs were, not just immediately, but into the foreseeable future as well, always remembering that Phoenix was a coordinative function. As a result, the Military Intelligence Branch of the Army, on instructions from the Acting Chief of Staff for Intelligence, actively began identifying in the United States people to volunteer as Phoenix advisors, on the understanding that they would be able to choose their next assignment after Vietnam. This would eventually develop into what was called the Phoenix Career Program. Phoenix curriculum was soon introduced to the Foreign Service Institute, the Defense Intelligence School, the Army Intelligence School, the Institute for Military Assistance at Fort Bragg, the Civil Affairs School at Fort Gordon, home of the military police, the Army Intelligence School in Okinawa, and Joint U.S. Military Advisory Group in Thailand. Walter Cullen then returned to Vung Tau, where he supervised the creation of the 10-day bimonthly Phoenix Coordinators Orientation Course. The staff was originally about a dozen people. Some were former DIOCC advisors, and the CIA also supplied a number of guest lecturers. About his experience as a Phoenix facilitator, Henry McQuade said, I gave two classes. The first class was How the DIOCC Should Be, set forth in SOP 1 and SOP 2. In the second class I said, forget the first class, this is how it really is. Then I explained how they had to adjust to the Vietnamese, how they would get money for expenditures but no money for bodies, and how sometimes they would get money for agents. Cullen and his deputy, Major Kelly Stewart, also provided advice and support to special branch training courses begun in Bienhoa in December 1968, then expanded to the other corps. In this capacity, Cullen traveled with Ed Brady and Loi Nguyen Tan. By the end of 1969, corps centers had trained 1,800 students, primarily in how to be case officers. Beginning in February 1969, American advisors to ARVN Ranger battalions, along with police advisors and Free World Military Assistance Forces, were also given Phoenix instruction. In addition to classes at Vung Tau, the CIA gave instruction to Phoenix advisors at the Vietnamese Central Intelligence School. John Cook attended one of the sessions. He writes, "There were 40 of us in the class, half American, half Vietnamese. The first day at the school was devoted to lectures by American experts in the insurgency business. Using a smooth, slick delivery, they reviewed all the popular theories concerning communist-oriented revolutions. Like so many machines programmed to perform at a higher level than necessary, they dealt with platitudes and theories far above our dirty little war. They spoke in impersonal tones about what had to be done and how we should do it, as if we were in the business of selling life insurance, with a bonus going to the man who sold the most policies. Those districts that were performing well with a quota system were praised, the poor performers were admonished, and it all fitted together nicely with all the charts and figures they offered as support of their ideas." Like many of his colleagues, Cook resented the pretentious men in high position who gave him unattainable goals, then complained when he did not reach them. In particular, as a result of mounting criticism in the American press, Phoenix advisors were called to task for their failure to capture rather than kill VCI. The problem stemmed from the press's equating Phoenix with the PRU teams it employed. For example, in December 1967, the Minneapolis Tribune described the PRU as specially trained Vietnamese assassins who slip silently by night into sleeping hamlets to carry out their deadly function. The Tribune noted, "This aspect of ISIS has a tradition that goes far beyond the Vietnam conflict, and its methods are those of hired killers everywhere." The hired killer label was to stick to Phoenix, with hapless DIOCC advisors taking the heat for PRU advisors conducting their business with impunity. Writing for the Wall Street Journal on September 5, 1968, reporter Peter Kahn described the VCI as the invisible foe, adding that the target is assassinated, sometimes brutally, as an object lesson to others. In this way, Phoenix developed a reputation as an assassination program. That is why it became imperative that the CIA disassociate itself from the program through public statements building a case for plausible denial. Such was the tack William Colby took at a press conference held for 30 news correspondents on December 28, 1968, in response to mounting public queries about Phoenix. In his opening statement, Colby called Phoenix a Vietnamese program in which Americans were involved only as part of military operations. The MACV information officer assisting Colby added that no American units were allocated to Phoenix. Colby stressed that the goal was to capture, not to kill, VCI. Nothing was said about wanted dead or alive posters, the PRU, or the Army's Combined Reconnaissance and Intelligence Platoons, CRIPS, which Jeffrey Race calls far more effective than even the PRU at eliminating members of the VCI. When asked how advisors prevented people from using Phoenix as a cover for political assassination, Colby cited systematic record-keeping as the fail-safe mechanism, producing charts and graphs to show statistics backing his claims. He did not mention the massacre of Key's people on June 2, 1968, or Tran Van Don's claim that Phoenix helped Trong Dinh Du in the 1967 election, or the station's special unit whose victims' names never appeared on Phoenix rolls. Colby made no reference to the CIA's having built the province interrogation centers and said that advisors were seldom present at interrogations. He then outlined American-conceived legal procedures for detaining suspects. The essence of Colby's dissembling was his definition of Phoenix as an organization rather than a concept. As stated in the previous chapter, when Ed Brady was asked if Phoenix generated atrocities, his answer was that it depended on whether or not the PRU and the PICS were defined as part of Phoenix. The reason for Colby's ignoring these two foundation stones of Phoenix was to conceal CIA involvement in the program, as well as to protect unilateral CIA penetrations, what Nelson Brigham called the most important program in terms of gathering intelligence on the enemy, what Jim Ward called the real sensitive important operations. And according to Colby, it worked. We were getting more and more accurate reports from inside VCI provincial committees and regional party headquarters from brave Vietnamese holding high ranks in such groups. Cords provided an umbrella, said John Van's deputy Jack, but people, especially the CIA, were always back-channeling through their own agencies to undermine it. Comer insisted that CIA people would run Phoenix through regular channels, but on highly sensitive matters like tracking high penetrations, it wasn't reported in Cords. In a conversation with the author, Jack noted that the informal lines of command are more important than formal lines, that, as he put it, real power gravitates off the organizational charts. The way it gets organized isn't critical. It had to be done some way, and it can adapt. For example, in Hao Nia, it was military, while in Jia Ding, it was special branch. It has to be flexible to account for HES A and B hamlets as opposed to C and D hamlets. Military or police, depending on the environment. In any event, the CIA advised Special Branch had cognizance over Phoenix, and Phoenix was a concept, not an organization.